Welcome to South Asia Chat, a podcast brought to you by the Institute of South Asian Studies at the National University of Singapore. I'm your host, Ramita Iyer, research analyst at the Institute. In June 2023, Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi made an official state visit to Washington, marking the third official to be hosted by US President Joe Biden since taking office. The visit has been hailed as a demonstration of both sides' intention to take their bilateral cooperation to the next level. While there have been significant developments over the past few years, a number of challenges do remain. For this episode, I'm pleased to be joined by Dr. Yogesh Joshi, research fellow at ISAS. We will be examining Modi's visit to Washington and its implications on India-US relations. Yogesh, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Ramita. Glad to be here.
So one of the key outcomes of Modi's visit has been the Biden administration's commitment to enhancing India's defense capabilities. The joint statement that was released mentioned the transfer of technology from the US to India to indigenously produce jet engines. For nearly two decades now, we've seen that India and the US have steadily expanded their defense cooperation, but all engagement has taken place with a certain sense of caution. Given this, how important is the recent announcement for India, and do you see it as a turning point in bilateral defense ties?
Definitely, yes. Insofar, one can understand that this is the first time US is providing such critical technology to any of its partners, leave aside its allies. US has never parted ways with jet engine technology for any of its allies too. Since in that sense, this is a milestone, or as many are saying, a trailblazing event in the Indo-US defense partnership. It also kind of underlines, you know, what India has always expected or always looked for, which is the transfer of technology, critical technology, in the defense sector from the US. And India has always maintained that that is, in some sense, the threshold which US has to cross to cement the Indo-US defense relationship. Now, as you mentioned, India has been asking for jet engine technology since the 1980s, when the light combat aircraft project was first conceived. You know, some of these technologies were discussed right in the second administration of Indira Gandhi in 1980s, when the first framework for science and technology cooperation was signed. But nothing really eventually happened on that front for almost two decades. India still chose for its LCA program, the Tejas Mark 1 program, still choose the GE-404 engines, which are a precursors to the GE-414 engines, which are now being offered by the US. But the earlier engines were just bought wholesale from the US. But this time, almost 80% of critical jet technology will be offered to India. So, you know, India's own indigenous efforts have failed miserably, even when putting in almost 3,000 man hours on developing India's indigenous jet engine called the Kaveri. And some of these technologies, if you can look at, might appear to be very simple, but they are extremely sensitive. And India hasn't been able to develop that. So in that sense, insofar that this is the first of the defense deals where there is almost a complete transfer of technology, and that too in a critical sector such as jet engines, which will not only power the next set, the next generation of the Tejas or the light combat aircraft program called the Tejas Mark II fighter jets, but also the advanced medium combat aircraft, which is the fifth generation plus program India is currently embarked upon, but also the twin engine deck based fighters for the Indian Navy. So this whole enterprise with the GE has a potential to revolutionize India's capabilities in fighter aircrafts. and not only not only empower India's Air Force as well as the Navy, especially when it comes to their flying capabilities, but also may in the future, as India intends to become a major exporter of defense products world over, may catalyze also India's defense exports. So this is in some sense, these 30 years of India-US defense engagement, this is a critical output of those 3 decades of defense engagement.
So the joint statement also highlighted the restructuring of technological supply chains in Asia, focusing on greater engagement on techno-economic cooperation as part of Washington's new strategy to de-risk from China. Recently in March, during U.S. Commerce Secretary Gina Raimondo's visit to Delhi, a memorandum of understanding was signed between both sides on semiconductor supply chains as well. What are your thoughts on these developments?
So look, the whole idea of supply chain resilience and building an initiative between India and U.S. bilaterally, but also India and U.S., as you very well know, having worked in the IPF, that they are also looking at somehow de-risking their economies vis-a-vis their susceptibility to coercion and over-dependence on the Chinese economy, right? And that has started happening way before even the pandemic, because in some sense, these countries do feel that their over-dependence on China provides Beijing a tool to beat them over and create susceptibilities, especially which becomes extreme vulnerabilities in an era of intense geopolitical competition. So unlike the 1990s era of globalization, where economic efficiency and this whole idea of, this whole liberal idea that interdependence will lead to more peaceful relations have completely been undone. So states are looking less at economic efficiencies, but more at economic security. Similarly, unlike the previous idea that interdependence will lead to some kind of peaceful resolution of disputes, they now believe that interdependence, or in China's case, over-dependence on Chinese economy, actually creates immense vulnerabilities. So geopolitics literally is driving economics as of today. Right. And therefore, India and the US are collaborating together to reduce those dependencies on China. That includes semiconductors, which are critical technologies, but also on many other fronts, right? Pharmaceuticals, vaccines, for that matter. Many other domains where manufacturing, simply manufacturing, simple trade between nations in a sense. But particularly on some of the critical products where the economy is extremely dependent. So that also provides India with a kind of a geo-economic opportunity it hasn't had before. So what is very interesting is that India's push for greater economic activity to be placed in the Indian subcontinent is occurring in a era of deglobalization. Whereas when most of the supply chains shifted to China, that occurred in a period of globalization. So India is actually looking at this particular geopolitical anxiety, of the era of geopolitical anxiety, as a moment of geo-economic opportunity. And that gels well with the anxiety which the US is facing, especially with the rise of China, which was in some sense comforted by US assistance, both technologically, economically, investment-wise, to China in the 1990s and 2000s. So insofar, both the geopolitics and the geoeconomics alliance together in support of this remaking of global supply chains. India and US are going to collaborate. And semiconductors is an interesting case in that sense. As you rightly mentioned, they signed this MOU on semiconductor supply chains and innovation partnership. And in the joint statement, there was almost an investment of $2.5 billion. Micron is investing heavily. The Intel deal is still pending. But what is also happening is the US effort to create an ecosystem, right, by training Indian engineers. So if one looks at the joint statement, there's also US-based firms who are going to train and create knowledge centers. And that is a fundamental development because much of, you know, this is not just producing the chip. It is also developing the ecosystem under which such very complicated technologies, you know, that whole set of ecosystem which can help generate the knowledge and the human resources, you know, which are fundamentally required to propel that shift in supply chains at some point in time, because that is critical. So even if you want, you know, you just can't shift the factories. You need that human resource and that infrastructure to kind of sustain that over a period of time. And I think it's both India's opportunity, but also US vulnerability that is driving this. And particularly, look, if US has to combat China's rise, it necessarily has to combat China's rise as a technological power. And semiconductors, semiconductor chips, are still China's Achilles heel. So US is also capitalizing on its own advantages. And insofar, the India-US relationship, right, remains on an even keel. And also because there's no fundamental conflict of interest, right, between India and the US. And therefore, we will see more and more, not only these bilateral initiatives on reconfiguring of supply chains. And India is doing a lot when it comes to some other sectors, whether it is pharmaceutical vaccines, you know, clean energy for that matter, solar panels. You know, so the joint statement also underlines that an Indian firm is investing a lot in building solar panel factories in the US. And given that India is relatively, there's an economic side of it as well. You know, India is relatively still economically a more attractive option given the labor, you know, the cost of labor and other things. And if the infrastructure push, which the current government is taking in India, right? So if you can create those incentives, both for the businesses, create the right atmosphere, and given that you have this this geopolitical and geoeconomic opportunity, right, beckoning at your doorsteps, I think that's the right kind of environment to assist this reconfiguration of supply chains. And that's what is happening at this point in time.
So you mentioned the IPEF, the Indo-Pacific Economic Framework, which was featured in another key element from the visit, which is on the statements that came out on the commitment of both sides to multilateralism. So the IPEF is an 14-country group, a U.S.-led economic initiative, and there's also the Quad, or the Quadrilateral Security Dialogue Forum, which consists of Australia, India, Japan, and the U.S. What is the progress of these groupings, and what are the prospects of multilateralism in the coming months?
So as you know, as you very well know, the IPEF again, you know, started in May 2022, right? And this is a more of a multilateral framework of U.S. allies and partners. So the IPF itself says the U.S. allies and partners, right? 14 countries, Southeast Asia, East Asia, and the Indo-Pacific mostly. Again, the attempt here is, what is happening today? We need to kind of understand why, you know, first of all, that why is US putting so much of an effort to create this Indo-Pacific economic framework, which is largely that security partnerships, security alliances will henceforth drive economic activity. It will not be vice versa. Especially during the period of globalization, it didn't really matter, you know, whom you are trading with, who are your trade partners, where the economic activity is getting concentrated on. But what IPEF is a clear example of how security is now driving economy, and this will be more and more so. Having said that, this is again not a usual conventional free trade agreement. There are four pillars to it. The trade pillar, the supply chain pillar, the clean economy pillar, and the fair economy pillar. Now, really nobody knows what this would be in concrete terms. To me, as an outside observer who looks at, you know, many of geoeconomics from a geopolitics angle, what I reckon is that what the US is trying to do is to rally its allies and partners in some sense to counter China's rise, but also an effort that it doesn't really lead to a completely deglobalized world. So globalization within its security allies and partners, that's the way to go about, you know, countering China's rise and de-risking the US economy and other economies from over-dependence on China. Now, we haven't seen a lot of signal, and correct me if I'm wrong, we haven't seen a lot of development on the trade side. The most developed aspect of the IPF so far are the supply chains, supply chains bit of it. Where, you know, according to the last statements I've seen, or even the Indo-US joint statement, substantial conclusions have been reached. And on fair economy and clean economy, we are in an advanced stage of negotiations. So this, what it appears to me is that US is within these four broad pillars of the IPF, you would see substantial agreement on some of the pillars where all states who, you know, in a sense that way, which might not be so conflictual, and I guess where states have far more shared interest than they might have in trade, right? So even in India-US case, right, in leave aside China, the trade has been a major issue for India, even with like-minded countries, right? And it is also a very sensitive domestic politics issue. So one of those pillars would really not, I think, would take substantial amount of effort to reach to some kind of conclusion. So at this stage, what I think is, this is an overall framework to kind of align people together in how US thinks that global economy should be realigned away from China. And insofar that shared understanding can be agreed upon within these 14 major economies spread across the Indo-Pacific, and which dovetails into, US's Indo-Pacific strategy. So for a long period of time, the Indo-Pacific strategy didn't really have an economic component. And that's what, you know, all the states in the region have been complaining about. Okay, fine, you want us to kind of, you know, deal with, or in some sense, understand better our own interests and insecurities vis-a-vis China. But these are not just territorial insecurities, right? These are not just security insecurities, but we also are heavily dependent upon China for our economic well-being. And much of international politics is domestic politics, right? Many of the elites in Southeast Asia, particularly, or even in East Asia, whether in Korea and Japan, you know, are highly dependent upon the Chinese economy. So, in some sense, US, Washington DC came to understand gradually that it has to give an economic alternative of to all these countries who are so intertwined with the Chinese economy, to help them also take upon China in terms of security issues they face with. Because otherwise they would just bandwagon with China, or at least not take up issues they really, which impinge on their national security, which was happening with Vietnam and Philippines for quite some time, right? So it's in my understanding, it is an effort to bring together all these major critical economies and states in the Indo-Pacific to kind of build a shared understanding of how, we can tackle the rise of China without, imposing severe economic penalties on these countries. But this will take quite some time to arrive to, So clean economy and fair economy, again, in some sense, obliquely targets the BRI, right? Without the BRI, we would not have been talking about not so much clean economy, but fair economy, right? Clean economy, again, is linked to climate change and, the new technologies which are coming up. So it's both incentives which US might offer as the harbinger of many of these new technologies which help us combat climate change, but also increase efficiency within the economy, or the economic transformation based upon new technologies we are looking at, but also counter the narrative, the values which China has tried to kind of, propagate through its own politico-economic model. So I think it's a battle at all of those levels.
Well, broadly looking at India-US ties, some experts have, given the recent developments, highlighted a paradox in the strategic ties due to India's close ties with Russia, ranging from reservations due to India's proximity to the Soviet Union during the Cold War years, to even Delhi's present-day dependence on Moscow in the defense sector. There are also concerns about Modi's autocratic tendencies that have been voiced every now and then. Do you see this as a paradox, or is the China factor and Delhi and Washington's mutual interest in containing Beijing in the Indo-Pacific region sufficient to significantly enhance their strategic cooperation?
So there are a number of questions here. Let me take them one by one, right? So first the Russia question, So I think it's, in some sense, it's a dead horse. It's more like expectations from the US, and especially among the commentariat, not so much within the government. And insofar, the tone and tenor of Indo-US relations, kind of suggest, and especially starting from February 2022, when Vladimir Putin actually went inside Ukraine, right? The tone of the US government has been very different from, the analysts and the commentariat in the US, so to say, or in Europe. There are two or three factors here. First of all, I think US understands that there's an asymmetry of interests of when we start comparing India's interest in Ukraine and American interests in India vis-a-vis China. So there's a fundamental asymmetry of interest there. So India is not as invested in Ukraine, or would ever be, as US would be invested in India vis-a-vis China. So there's a fundamental, asymmetry of interests. And insofar that US interests in India vis-a-vis China would always overpower India's relations with Russia, it doesn't matter to Delhi what all, people in Washington DC might be saying. Coming to brass tacks, it's about China. So the first thing first. The second thing is that geography matters, right? US is a global power. India is not. And insofar, coming together of China and Russia creates a block of Eurasian authoritarians, which then combined with similar countries from Iran to Pakistan to North Korea, it basically creates a very difficult situation for India which is looking over the Himalayas at this huge continental landmass of Eurasia, which, unlike any other ally, which are one removed from the real geography of Eurasia. So India's geography, and therefore India's interest, would always be very different compared to US interests in Ukraine vis-a-vis Russia, and India's interest in keeping Russia, to the extent it can, autonomous from China. It might be, and there are increasing indications, that Russia might become or has become a junior partner. But the underlying emphasis on India's approach to Russia has been that you need Russia to keep Asia multipolar. Right? So insofar, even when Russia can have, and also there is a significant, in some sense, expectation or trust that Russia can never be tamed. So, insofar, India's attempt is to create an autonomous Russia, at least, or to the extent it can slow down the process of Russia becoming a junior partner of China, it will try to do that. Because India's aim, fundamentally, is not a multipolar world. It is a multipolar Asia. Because the route to multipolar world comes from a multipolar Asia. If Asia is not multipolar, then the dreams of a multipolar world are all, are dreams, literally. So, insofar that geography and that ambition of creating or at least having a multipolar Asia is concerned, Russia is critical for India. And then we can talk about the defense deals and all that, but that is much more transactional. Yes, there is a legacy issue and all of that, but it is not as if India cannot do without Russia. But also, why would India not take whatever it gets from any country? If India stops buying Russian arms, what will happen to Russian economy? Right? That also means that much of this technology, which is pretty good technology, right? It might not be as effective or as trailblazing in terms of American technology, but it is also not that costly. But also that if it goes all to China and Russia becomes completely dependent on China, then many of the obstacles which China faces in terms of defense technology will be far removed. So those are the matrix on which India is making its calculation. But fundamentally, it's about symmetry of interest. Insofar, they are both focused on China. I think the Indo-US relationship is not going to be harmed by the trajectory of India-Russia relations. I don't think so, and we have the evidence for last two years, right? Almost 1.5 years or whatever it is, that there hasn't been a lot of impact. In fact, if one goes by the evidence of this particular joint statement and Modi's visit to the U.S., in fact, it has dawned upon the U.S. to kind of, attract India much more than before. It hasn't shunned India for what it has done, its statement on Russia and its, kind of neutrality on Ukraine. It has actually embraced India more. So in some sense, it falsifies the whole narrative that, the India-Russia relationship is going to derail the India-US relationship. I don't think so. So second, coming to the democracy element, right? So these are the two major, in some sense, possible roadblocks, right? Or possible bumps in this very smooth ride which we are thinking, the Indo-US relations are on now. So one of the fears which many in US commentariat have argued is that an illiberal democracy like India, if we support an illiberal democracy like India, it might challenge us just like China did, right, tomorrow. So there are two things here. First, that there is no guarantee in international politics that tomorrow a rising power will not challenge you. So you can't ask for a guarantee, in a sense. But second, that we need to understand that unlike China or Russia, India doesn't threaten any of the US interests in the Indo-Pacific, right? India is not threatening any of the allies of the US. So there is no real fundamental conflict of interest. So even when, you know, there might be friction down the line in the US relationship, it would be much more on the values and norms of international politics and India's recognition as a great power, right? But which US has done over a period of time. So why has US supported India's rise in the system? It's not because of China alone, but it's also because, unlike Russia and China, US and India have no fundamental conflict of interest. And US has already, already agreed to, in some sense, India's supremacy in the Indian Ocean. And there is nothing left beyond that. So if India is going to hegemonize, it's going to hegemonize in the Indian Ocean rather than anywhere else. Because there is no space for any hegemonizing effort on its continental borders. Right? It's a very status quo power in that sense. And if that has already been agreed, then I don't see there is a lot of there should be a lot of worry on how an illiberal democracy aided by America, would use its rise to challenge the US, right? So there is not much there. But also that, just the fact that if India is an illiberal democracy today, and if it was a perfect democracy in the first 50 years of its independence, what was happening to the Indo-US relations then? So yeah, to kind of use selective evidence is also a major issue. But fundamentally, international politics is driven by interests, right? India-US relations are here today not because they both are democracies, right? Because they share shared interests. And the democracy bit is a cherry, it's icing on the cake, but it's not the cake. The cake are the interests which have brought these two countries together, and it is in some sense fundamentally about China. What else they share is no fundamental conflict of interest, and that is the base on which this relationship is founded. Yes, one should not worry about, democratic trends in India. Obviously, yes, but, in a sense that you cannot expect external, pressure on India to lead to some kind of internal change, right? India, in that sense, is a vibrant democracy. One may call it electoral democracy, but at the end of the day, that's the iron test of democratic accountability. And India in some sense has always been a liberal democracy. In a sense that it, the whole argument just then, is based upon semantics. And semantics really doesn't allow you to do a lot of analysis here. And I don't want to get into the argument that that US had strategic relationship with non-democracies and all that, because that's not the point. The point is that you don't have a fundamental conflict of interest, not even in the foreseeable future, and you share very robust interests at this point in time, not only in terms of the security dynamics, but also economically, as well as how you want to shape the international system, right? And I also think that the Indians acknowledge that India's rise would not have happened without the US, and could not happen without persistent support from the US. And that is something which the Indian decision makers very well know. So I don't think that, yes, you know, India should, you know, democracy should be made more robust. Yes, but that is much more an internal process. And I don't think that Indo-US relations would have any impact on how, you know, the democratic systems kind of, you know, unravel themselves in India or democratic processes influence. But also that is not something which drives this relationship.
Thanks for sharing your insights, Yogesh. You were listening to South Asia Chat. To learn more about our work, visit us at isas.nus.edu.sg. You can also get updates on social media. We're on Twitter, LinkedIn, Facebook, and Instagram.